This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. A lot of people are wondering what to do about America's massive student loan debt. And here's an idea that seems to be catching on. How about another way of paying for higher education, where you pay only if your education gets you a job? And there's an online school in San Francisco called the Lambda School, which is going to try this out. It's founded by Austin Allred, who, I guess, technically speaking, you are a college dropout. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
You went to BYU and decided that you weren't learning anything? Tell me about that.
The pace of what I was learning and how it was shaping up was different than I would have expected. Decided to take a different path.
So you decided to found a school where, first of all, Lambda is teaching primarily coding?
Yeah, computer science and data science, yeah.
And you're using a tuition concept called income sharing. So how does that work?
Nope, there's no upfront payment whatsoever, and you don't pay a penny until you get a high-paying job.
The model, I know, has been proposed before as a way of allowing promising students to go to school, but, of course, the question has always been, how can you guarantee the payback? You managed to create a model attractive enough that you got millions of dollars in private investment. How much did you raise for this idea, Austin?
We have raised $48 million total.
From people including Ashton Kutcher, the actor, correct?
Yep, Ashton as well.
So what interested him and the others in this? Well, why did it sound like a money-making operation to them?
Yeah, so normally when people try to create these kinds of financial instruments, they just buy loans for people or pay for tuition for them in exchange for a share of future income. What we're doing is a little bit different. So we've actually created an entire school that operates around that idea. So a school that's completely incentivized to get its students jobs, and it's working really well.
So how many students do you have enrolled right now?
We have just over 1,000 students enrolled right now.
That's pretty good. And the deal is that they don't pay tuition until they get a job?
Correct.
And that at that point, how much do they pay?
They pay 17% for 2 years of their income, capped at 30K. So they can never pay more than 30K. And they only pay when their job is paying more than $50,000 a year. So if it's below that, they don't pay anything.
Okay, so if they don't get a job or their job pays below 50K, they're not paying any tuition.
Correct.
Now, if they do qualify to pay tuition at 17%, how long do they end up paying that?
2 years.
2 years maximum, really?
Yep.
And that pencils out? That allows you to make a profit?
Yep. If all of your students get hired, there are really good margins there.
Is this, I know that other schools, more traditional brick-and-mortar schools, have flirted with this idea. Do you think it could work for them, or is it only appropriate for this kind of online model?
I think it could work for them. You know, they have a bigger dollar amount that they need to cover because they're an offline school. I mean, we still have highly paid instructors and a lot of that, but, you know, basically all of our budget goes directly into instruction and helping students get jobs. We don't do anything else. So we definitely have a different cost structure. So that lets us, you know, be a smaller percentage for a shorter amount of time. But in theory, it could work for other schools as well.
You're not trying to run a football team. You don't have a giant landscaping department. You're not trimming the ivy on the buildings, right?
No buildings, very small administrative staff. Everything goes directly to the students.
I saw the New York Times article about your school, and they quoted some other academics as being concerned that a school that runs on this model obviously can only afford to teach the kind of subjects that have a payoff. So if you're going to become an expert in medieval Russian literature, this is obviously not going to work. Is there any concern on your part that it's good for educating software engineers, but for a liberal arts degree, it wouldn't work. And so you might see those degrees wither away.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we are big enough or influential enough to make any sort of degree wither away. But yeah, our goal is not to be a liberal arts degree. We are a vocational school. That doesn't mean liberal arts degrees can't exist and that we're the only option. I think universities will be just fine.
How do you supervise the caliber of instruction? Because, of course, it is very important to you that your students, I mean, your existence depends on your students succeeding in a way that it really doesn't with other institutions. Although I have to say, there is some of that, right, in the traditional model. Harvard picks its students with an idea that once they become truly wealthy, they'll start getting calls from the alumni office, you know, to support the school. But I mean, for you guys, if the education doesn't work, your cash flow just stops.
Yeah. If we train a batch of students and they don't get jobs, we lose money on that batch. And there's no coming back from that. So yeah, the quality of instructors is very important to us. All of our instructors are full-time employees. We've got about 30 of them full-time right now. We have another 90 part-time people that show up for 20 or 30 hours a week. And the answer is we measure it. We measure how the students are doing every week. We see what the student rating or net promoter score is every week. We can pop in on any lecture. We actually archive everything that ever happens. So you can go back at any time and review any point of class ever. So we can also do that as an administrative staff. And yeah, the instructors understand that they have eyes watching them and they need to perform.
So instructors are rated according to their students' success?
Yeah, so we look at a few different measures. We look at how their students have performed on that unit. We kind of grade students every week, see how they're doing. The students give a score for the instructor. They give a score for the program generally. And, you know, some students may not like hard instructors. We understand that that's not a perfect measure, but we get a lot of data and look at everything very closely.
So have you ever had to fire an instructor whose students were not succeeding to the degree they were supposed to?
We have, yeah.
That's something teachers generally do not like. Do you find it hard to recruit when that's the standard?
We've actually found the reverse. It may not be a good fit for all teachers, but there are quite a few that are kind of looking for an environment where, you know, the flip side of that is we will give a teacher anything they need to be successful, whether that's bigger budget or whether that's more time or, you know, whatever it is. We just want our students to be successful. And that's a little bit different than some institutions. So they really appreciate that.
Yeah. Now, does that come in the form of a higher salary for the better instructors or something else?
It does. It mostly comes as the school doing everything it possibly can to help students out. We actually have a nonprofit fund. So if a student falls behind on bills or is out of housing or needs a computer, depending on the circumstances, we may just take care of that. We put a lot of investment, cash and otherwise, into our student success.
So there's a free market incentive aspect here too, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly.
So you have 1,000 students enrolled now. What's your growth curve look like?
It's pretty intense. We're growing about 15% month over month.
Month over month?
Yep.
How long does it take to get a degree?
So it's 9 months full-time or a little over a year part-time. It's not technically a degree program. It's just just training. Yeah.
So 9 months from unemployment to employment, no tuition necessary until you get a job.
Correct.
Wow. Austin Allred is the founder of the Lambda School, which uses the income sharing method of tuition payment. And Austin, thanks for making the time available. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
A lot of us have asked, well, how is it that so many people have become homeless in the first place? Why can't we prevent that from happening? Well, here's how it happens. A group of seniors who thought they could live out their lives in a mobile home park in Seattle's Bitter Lake neighborhood now find themselves facing eviction. They're going to make their case to the city council this afternoon. And Hannah Scott's been following this story. What happened?
So, Dave, we're talking about the Halcyon Mobile Home Park, where nearly 80 low-income seniors have called home for decades, including 74-year-old Eloise Mickelson, who moved in nearly 20 years ago.
I downsized and bought my house and started investing in the rehabilitating it because my unit was put here in 1967. So I had to do new windows, modernization, all kinds of upgrades to make it a comfortable living space.
And she and all of her neighbors are a tight-knit senior community who own their homes, but not the land they sit on. The owner had promised that the land would never be sold, and Eloise and her neighbors believed they were secure and would be able to age in place. But the owner died, and now the land is about to be sold to a Kirkland developer. If that happens, Eloise says she and her neighbors could end up on the streets.
Nobody has a clue where to go. I mean, some of these people have been here 30 and 40 years, and they're old. They're 70, 80, 90 years old. I broke my heart to see the emotional fear and denial and just unable to comprehend the situation that we're in. It's unbelievable that they're going to try and put us out in the streets to build home those units, townhouses on this land that none of us can afford to get in.
Now, Louise and her neighbors have been reaching out to the city and even the state representatives for months and now have the ear of City Council member Shama Sawant, who will take their issue up at her committee meeting this afternoon.
It's a little bit like the Showbox, the Save the Showbox struggle, where the movement and my office was urging the City Council to urgently pass a legislation that would at least for the moment give a reprieve from the sale of the land so that we can figure the next steps out. So that's what urgently is needed to do here as well. But that won't be enough. Obviously, that is only step number one. We also have to discuss what can actually be done to permanently make sure that these residents they're not evicted and don't become homeless.
So beyond asking the council to take an emergency action to temporarily stop the sale, Sawant also wants the council to look at other options long term, such as a new zoning law in Portland that specifically protects mobile home parks from development, or maybe even having the city buy this property. But Sawant says others on the council seem less enthusiastic. Now, that's because this property is linked to the ongoing debate over mandatory housing affordability and upzoning, where developers are allowed to build higher up so long as they dedicate a certain amount of the units as low income or pay fees to have those low income units built elsewhere. When Sawant proposed removing the mobile home park from the upzone, Councilmember Rob Johnson this week suggested it may do more harm than good.
Leaving out parcels from the mandatory housing affordability program, I think that puts a greater emphasis on those areas for likely redevelopment, because again, a developer wouldn't be required to pay or perform under the city affordable housing program. So I get concerned about leaving out pockets of the city.
But wait a minute, so they're going to remove these affordable mobile homes in the name of building more affordable housing?
So yes, it's very, very complicated, but essentially what he's saying there is, right now, most of that neighborhood is part of this upzoning plan, mandatory affordable housing, and he thinks it becomes
a bigger target. It's nice to build more affordable housing, but the people aren't like chess pieces.
Yeah.
You have to move them somewhere. So wouldn't it make sense to build the affordable housing first and then let these people move into that at what they're paying now, and then redevelop the land they're on?
Absolutely, and I expect that will be part of the discussion, and that was Sawant's point when he said that.
It is not an option, in my mind, to allow the displacement, eviction, and very real prospect of homelessness for many of these senior residents.
And it's all a bit political for Eloise, who just wants a sense of security for herself and her neighbors.
When you live in a community that you serve and you look after, and you get up at night when they got emergencies and go to hospitals and you hold their hand while they're dying, you can't just walk away from it.
She and those of her neighbors who can get there today will be at City Hall with activists to plead their case to the City Council as Sawant asks for those changes.
Yeah. How big is this parcel, and do we know who the new owner is?
It's a Kirkland developer. I believe it's called Blue Fern is the name of the developer.
This, of course, is the thing that kills development projects when you get involved in a controversy like this. Didn't they consider that before either buying the property or announcing their plans?
I reached out to them yesterday. I did not hear back, so I'm not sure what they've considered. Hopefully I will hear back and I can keep this story updated. This is about 80 seniors, I believe, live on this property. I believe some of them are doubled up. So there's dozens of these mobile homes there. And I think what she had told me with this was, and I didn't have time to investigate it on my own, but this was an old landfill that decades and decades ago these mobile homes were put on top of. And they invested everything. They don't know going to do.
I mean, this is exactly how it happens, right? You have people who they're minding their own business, of course. They're supporting themselves. They own their homes. They're not a burden on the city. And now suddenly, all of them will be.
Yeah.
This is allowed to happen.
And that's a problem. And this is also leads to a part of a bigger discussion. So mandatory housing affordability is, there are several meetings going on, a couple of this week, and it's expected to be finally voted on in March. But displacement is a big part of this conversation, not just particularly to this park. This is one getting a lot of the attention right now. But overall, there are council members who have concerns about that. So I expect we'll see some of that hashed out more. Right now, the sense of urgency for this park.
All right, it's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
There are no scheduled shutdown negotiations today. And I half expect that Nancy Pelosi is going to take a pair of scissors and cut the president's tie in half. And then he's going to throw a pie and then she's going to snap his suspenders. We called up Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan to see just how far this will all go.
Sophomoric behavior is how Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, described it. And he used that word to refer not only to the president, but also to the speaker for what happened this week. It just shows you that, you know, we're talking about the president pulling a government aircraft away from the speaker and Democrats in the House telling them they can't visit troops in Afghanistan until the government reopens. Speaker Pelosi said the president shouldn't come give a State of the Union January 29th, reschedule it for when the government reopens. She cited security concerns because of the shutdown. So both of them agree the shutdown's a problem, but neither of them are actually doing anything at this point in terms of credible negotiations to end it. And that's where we are right now. And it leaves so many of those federal workers in this gray area. Some at the State Department, some in other areas of government are getting called back and being told they have a few weeks of pay that they know they can sort of cobble together from other areas to pay them for a few more weeks. But again, this is temporary. So many others, TSA agents, Secret Service agents, aren't clear on when their next paycheck is coming, and this is going to be more and more of an issue. We're going to talk about it on Face the Nation this weekend.
And I hear that the administration is expanding the definition of what constitutes an essential employee as a basis for forcing them back to work, but they still don't get paid.
Well, some do, some don't. The State Department, they have told they will have a few weeks' pay, and we knew that about 40% of them domestically weren't getting paid. 26% of them working abroad in embassies around the world aren't getting paid. Why does that matter? Well, how do you pay your rent? And how do you pay your rent in a foreign country, explaining to a foreign government, well, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump are arguing, therefore I can't pay.
Right.
You know, this complicates the lives. There are others who don't have that clarity even at this point. And that's what you're talking about with these TSA agents in particular. How do you define who is essential? There are so many people who are sitting at home now who would like to go back to work or unable to get a second job because of the restrictions of working for the government and really having a hard time making ends meet.
Yeah, like two parents having a fight and they decide, let's starve the children. Now, in terms of relations with Congress, I noticed commentator Larry Sabato was talking about this latest Michael Cohen revelation that Cohen says he was actually ordered by Trump to lie to Congress. And here's what Sabato had to say.
This is as serious as it gets. We're talking suborning perjury and obstruction of justice. Those are clearly impeachable offenses.
And Sabato says that for now, Mitch McConnell is all that really stands between Trump and impeachment.
Well, there are two questions. One's legal and one's political. For actual impeachment to move forward, which, by the way, there have been articles introduced in the House, but Democratic leadership says this is way too early. You've got to have that political calculation that if it passes through the House, that the Senate would be in a position to convict. To do that, you need 20 Republican senators to say, I've had enough, and this crosses the bar for me, you know, that the president should not remain, you know, at least untouched and not challenged. That's two-thirds of the Senate. We do not yet see Republicans at the point where they're saying they're willing to vote that way should impeachment go forward. Legally, however, this is what's so interesting is what's described in this BuzzFeed article, which I should point out CBS News hasn't confirmed yet, does seem to meet the standard that the Attorney General nominee William Barr laid out this week during his confirmation hearings as to legally for him what constitutes obstruction of justice. And so legally, you may see that we're moving closer to areas where you can't dispute this anymore, that if the attorney general's on record saying this could add up to obstruction, that it needs to be taken seriously by Republicans.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. Her guests this Sunday include Senator Joe Kennedy and presidential candidate Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. You know what this is, right? You know why he's playing this.
I have no idea.
Walking on Broken Glass.
Oh,
Walking on Broken Glass.
Brilliant. That James is brilliant.
Yeah, he is.
Give that man a raise.
Here is Cairo critic Tom Tangney, who has lots of splaining to do to explain the third movie in this series that a lot of people didn't realize it was a series.
I think that's right. Now, I understand that my colleague, Michael Medved, just railed on this movie,
oh, man. Yeah.
Tore it to bits, and we're going to hear from him. Are we going to hear from him afterwards or beforehand? I would suggest beforehand.
Okay. I don't see it here. Which
okay.
one is it?
And just to give you a
sense.
Oh,
yeah, here it is. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Oh, it's in development. Okay.
Oh, it's in development. Okay, good enough. And just to put this in perspective, Jason from KTTH, who also sees this movie, he loved it. Medved hated it. I'm here to be the voice of reason. I'm somewhere in between.
As usual.
Okay. So, as the long build-up to the climax of Glass begins, one of the characters says, "I've been waiting 19 years for this!" Now, it's something of an inside joke. With Glass, writer-director M. Night Shyamalan is wrapping up his surprise trilogy that began with Unbreakable in 2000 and continued with 2017's Split. Yep, that's 19 years worth of filmmaking, to which I have only one question. You waited 19 years for this? Briefly, Unbreakable is about a man named David Dunn, played by Bruce Willis, who's the only survivor of a horrific train crash. He's contacted by a brilliant thinker and comic book enthusiast named Elijah Price, played by Samuel L. Jackson, who convinces Dunn that he very well may be a superhero. Seemingly unrelated, Split is about a man named Kevin Wendell Crumb, played by James McAvoy, who suffers from multiple personalities, 24 to be exact, one of which is a kidnapper and killer who preys on teenage girls. Only in Split's final frames does David Dunn show up, closely following news reports about a murderous rampage by Crumb. After a 17-year hiatus, a Shyamalan trilogy suddenly seemed to be in the works. And now, 2 years later, Glass is the culmination. Expectations were high that Shyamalan might finally be able to restore his reputation, which soared after The Sixth Sense, but dipped considerably since then. Perhaps trying too hard to prove himself, he delivers a studious, but rather ponderous, lumbering even, examination of an idea that's not worth all that much. Offering very few thrills or chills or even any sense of fun, Glass takes itself far too seriously to take seriously. It talks itself to death, kind of like this review.
Yeah.
The film does at least offer us a meeting of the mind, so to speak, between the trilogy's three main characters. Elijah Prince, a.k.a. Mr. Glass, has been held for years in a psychiatric hospital, and he's soon joined by both David Dunn and Kevin Crumb. Dunn had been working as an undercover vigilante dubbed the Overseer when he confronts Kevin Crumb, who, as the Beast, was in the midst of another serial killing spree. Both were arrested by police, determined to be mentally unstable, and left in the hands of a psychiatrist who's determined to break all of them out of their delusions.
The three of you have convinced yourselves you have extraordinary gifts, like something out of a comic book. But what I am questioning is your belief that you are something more than human.
In a very talky session, the psychiatrist, who bills herself as an expert in comic book-based delusions of grandeur, tries to explain away their supposed superhero talents as being little more than flukes, accidents of fate, or simple misinterpretations. But Price is having none of it.
Everything extraordinary can be explained away, and yet it is true. I think deep down you know this. Everything we will see and do will have a basis in science, but it will have limits. This is the real world, not a cartoon. And yet some of us don't die from bullets. Some of us can still bend steel. That is not a fantasy.
Price is convinced the three of them are living out their comic book destinies. Crumb is the ultimate villain, Dunn the reluctant hero, and Price, of course, the mastermind, the evil genius behind it all. It's hard not to see Shyamalan as Price. Unfortunately, Shyamalan doesn't seem nearly brilliant enough, at least based on this movie, to make that parallel convincing. I credit him for not making just another Marvel-like superhero movie. If anything, Glass seems like an anti-superhero superhero movie. Shyamalan seems to want us to take superheroes seriously and not cartoonishly, but maybe they're better as cartoons.
Okay. Here's what Michael Medved had to say. I think we strung these together, right? Yeah. This is a 20-second summary of Michael Medved's Glass review.
Outrageously hammy. Utterly incompetent. Badly edited. It's terrifyingly terrible. It is awful. It is the worst film of M. Night Shyamalan's career. And that's saying something. The only time it produces anything like an emotional response is one of nausea. I was going to give the film one star, but it really doesn't deserve that. It's a zero-star movie.
A zero-star movie. So how many tangs do you give it?
I give it 2.5 tangs out of 4, Dave. He tries so hard, this Shyamalan. He's so earnest about it. It's not a zero movie.
Tom, so, I actually saw the first one. You know, I don't normally see movies.
Yes.
Do you have to have seen, or should you prime yourself?
No, you do not. Believe me, I gave you so much information in my review. I don't think you need to see the other movies,
okay.
But it doesn't hurt. I think it's more Split-dependent than Unbreakable-dependent, but I think you could venture forth if you want to see a zero-star movie from Medved without having seen the other two. I'm not sure it's worth the investment of seeing all three movies, to tell you the truth, but it is an earnest effort at trying to make a superhero movie that doesn't look like a Marvel movie. I'm just not sure how valuable that is.
Tom Tangney. Thank you, Tom.
Anytime.
A little dose of kindness for you on this Friday. Officer David Liska, he's from Clive, Iowa, and he knows he's unique.
I don't write a lot of tickets because I'm kind of a softy.
But this day was different. KCCI-TV, that is, says he pulled over a car for expired tabs, and the driver was Lauren Bruner.
She knew they were expired. She had just got or just started a new job and was going to get a paycheck on Friday and try to get caught up. She teared up and she talked about depression and hospital stay. We have a daughter that has depression, and it just clicked.
Empathy kicked in. So he called his wife and said, hey, can you do me a favor? And the couple helped Lauren buy her car tabs and a month's worth of insurance. And as Lauren's glowing Facebook post reveals, even bought her a smoothie on the way home. Those little touches of kindness, it meant the world to her. Officer Liska says he was just doing the right thing, the human thing.
This job has exposed me to so much hurt in other people's lives. And I'm just generally empathetic by nature. There's really nothing special about us, honestly. I mean, we're just doing the same thing a lot of other people are doing. We just got caught, so to speak.
It was definitely her lucky day. How many times have you tried to explain a bad day to an officer? Doesn't always work.
Your Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is to tell us who to root against, Danny O'Neill. So
you need him to tell you? I could tell you that.
Okay. Who do you root against?
The Patriots.
Yes, you do. That's correct. Ding, 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 ding.
Wait a minute.
End of story.
They're the underdogs. They're putting out the word that they suck.
I thought that they couldn't be more annoying. I really did. And I was wrong because
that t-shirt.
The Patriots is under bet against us. Yeah, that's right. Go ahead. It's like cheering for the IRS, man. Like, seriously, like if the tax man came to you and said, yeah, go ahead and bet against us.
We've struggled for too long.
God, it's so
they got a really old quarterback.
Yeah, they do. He's 41.
41 years old.
Is that old for a quarterback? Yeah, I thought they could.
Well, no, he's getting toward the edge. He's getting toward the edge.
Who's
of
the oldest
of where
quarterback
you're
ever to play?
Warren Moon played into his mid-40s, but I'm sure that there were people... Like George Blanda, when you go back even further, I think Blanda, but he wasn't the full-time starter. I think when you get to championship-level quarterbacks, Brady's getting up there. This is about as old as anybody's been that's been playing for a title.
What's his wear and tear?
He's actually been pretty healthy. He blew out his knee early one year. That was 2008, and he missed that whole season. Otherwise, he's been incredibly durable. If you listen to his wife, Giselle, has talked about the concussions he's had, but that she's not supposed to talk about, and then she never talked about him again.
Well, I know she has him on a rigorous diet to keep him healthy.
Yeah, it's plant-based, right?
Right.
Yeah, and he's got a weird guru. He's got a trainer that's a snake oil salesman. I don't think he goes by that and puts it on
there.
You
say that, and yet he's playing football at the age of 41.
Yeah, I know. I'm not saying snake oil doesn't work. I'm just saying that this guy sells snake oil. He's actually been he's been disciplined by the
FDA.
Is the FDA? Is that
Food and Drug Administration?
Yeah, Alex Guerrero is his name. Yeah. So he's gotten in trouble
before.
So they're
not the underdogs, despite wanting to be painted as the underdogs. There's only, a 3-point spread between them and the Chiefs?
And it's going
to
be really, really cold. It's going to be so cold.
Are they playing in New England?
No, in Kansas City.
Oh, in Kansas City.
They have to go on the road. And Tom Brady's lost his last 3 road playoff games in the AFC. So that's one hope that I can, in fact, bet against.
But they've made the playoffs how many years in a row now?
Well, since 2008. So that would be 10 straight playoff bursts.
Yikes. So is that making the NFL reassess just how its parity policy? Because it's not working with the Patriots, apparently.
That's the only one it doesn't work with, though. Oh. Pretty much everybody else. And the Seahawks have had a pretty good run here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The fact that they've made 7 playoffs in 9 seasons is really, really good. But the Patriots are the only one. This is their 8th straight AFC championship. So it's the 8th time they've been a win away from going to the Super Bowl.
I'm sorry, but who knew the Chiefs were so good?
Yeah, we didn't think that they were going to take this step forward. They've got a great quarterback in Patrick Mahomes, who most people believe will end up getting the MVP award. He threw 50 touchdowns, passed for 5,000 yards. He's incredible to watch. He throws the ball differently. He's got what a pitcher would term different arm slots. He'll throw it. He'll throw it on the run. When you watch him, he plays differently than a lot of quarterbacks do. It's not this robotic step back, scan the field. He's moving. He's throwing across his body. He's got an unbelievable arm. He's pretty fun to watch. And he's paired with Andy Reid. And it's kind of like I've described them as couples, the coaches and the quarterbacks. Andy Reid has been around for a long time, and we always thought if he just got a better partner, he'd be much better. Like, we wondered, like, he's really good, and you just wish you could find somebody to really bring it out of him, because his last two partners, they've been okay. Donovan McNabb was fine, but it wasn't that great. And then Alex Smith, he's good. And Patrick Mahomes, they're awesome, and you're just so happy because your friend Andy Reid is just really blossomed.
I guess I know who you're rooting for.
Yeah, yeah. And then Belichick and Brady, they're like the couple that's been married so long that they don't even show public affection.
Right.
Like, when they're in the room together, you don't even know that they're married, because they're like, I've been around that person so long, I don't want to hear what they have to say anymore. Not even a chaste kiss on the cheek, Dave.
No.
Winning has just become so routine to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they have the gall to pretend to be miserable about it.
Oh, it's so hard to be so good. Well, you're making a pretty good case. I guess I could root against the Patriots.
Bet against us.
Yeah, bet against us.
It just seems so unpatriotic to root against the Patriots.
What?
So, I thought I'd sneak that past you. We're going to get another Lynch on the Seahawks?
Yeah, Paxton Lynch. He's about as opposite as you can get from Marshawn Lynch, though. He's got well-cultivated, well-groomed facial hair. Looks like a Guy Fawkes mask.
Now I have to look up. You always make me look up these people you describe.
You know the
I know the mask, but that is not really a pleasing demeanor.
Yeah, I'm telling you that his facial hair is weird.
Really?
Yeah. It's not his face. His face doesn't look like the mask, just the facial hair with the mustache and the little chin thing, and it flows up into the
see, Dave?
Yeah, it's unpleasant. He's going to be in his fourth season. He did not play in the league last year. He was a first-round pick by the Broncos who was released. He had a guaranteed contract of $1.3 million last year, so he didn't need to take the first job that came around. And
how far away are we from needing a backup quarterback on a regular basis? I remember the days when it was, you know, you'd have Matt Hasselbeck playing part of the time. It was like rotating quarterbacks for a while, and we haven't had that since Russell Wilson, of course. Is that day going to come?
I hope not. I hope we're 10 years away from needing another quarterback. Russell's turning 30, and he should be entering that prime window. Yeah. The question of durability, he's been fantastic. He's not indestructible. He is a man, but so far, he hasn't shown any sign. Quarterbacks stay healthy. Peyton Manning stayed healthy for the first 11 years of his career, where he didn't miss a game in that stretch. So it happens. Tom Brady's been incredibly healthy, except for the 1 year where his knee got blown out. So hopefully, knock on wood, as I wrap my knuckles furiously against my noggin, we won't need the backup quarterback. But Paxton Lynch is going to have a chance to compete for that job.
Hook Russell up with Brady's dietitian.
No! That guy sells snake oil, Dave. I've already established
vegetables.
This. Yeah, it is plant-based diet.
It's vegan snake oil.
Vegan snake oil. Yeah that would be the plant-based is also what Pete Carroll's doing.
Is he doing?
Is that what we call vegans now? It's plant-based? That's the term that they go by.
She's the vegan.
Yeah. I'm not a vegan.
Yeah.
Well, you're the former vegan.
Former vegetarian.
Whatever.
I could never give up cheese.
I love animals. They're delicious.
Well, I was a vegetarian for 5 years, got pregnant the first time, and then I was on the floor of my kitchen tearing apart a Costco chicken. That's when the vegetarianism ended.
Heck yeah, Colleen. That's fantastic.
I needed protein.
Yikes, wish we have video of that.
I imagine her eating it with little Tyrannosaurus arms. Oh.
I was a monster.
Brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
And now, how to predict which people will misuse guns and what to do about it. We have in this state extreme risk protection orders, affectionately known as ERPOs, which allow a court to temporarily suspend the person's gun rights if they are considered to be a threat to themselves or others. We have them here for adults, and now there's an effort to apply them to minors. This is being discussed now in the legislature, and that's what Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has been following.
Dave, there are a couple of different bills here, both the result of recommendations from the Mass Shooting Prevention Task Force that met over the spring and the summer. One is from Republican State Senator Steve O'Bann, the other from Democratic Senator David Frocht. There are some small differences between the two, but the gist is the same in both, allowing the court to issue an extreme risk protection order for minors who are deemed a threat by the court. Senator Frocht pointed to stats in a recent Washington Post breakdown of school shootings as reason for the change during a committee hearing yesterday.
In cases where the source of the gun could be determined in school shootings going back to 1998, since Columbine, more than 85% of the shooters brought guns from their own homes or obtained them from friends or relatives.
Since kids can't legally possess guns anyway, Frog says this really centers around kids having access.
The issue is people, young kids, getting the gun, access to the firearm from a home or someone they know. This bill would allow these petitions to be applied to people under the age of 18, which would have been possible in some of the instances we've seen, including some in our own state.
Kimberly Wyatt with the King County Prosecutor's Office was there. She says their specialized unit has worked on more than 70 extreme risk protection orders in 2018 alone involving adults and helped law enforcement agencies across the state with many others. In Seattle, police there were also at this committee hearing and say that they had worked with more than 100 and actually issued 42 of them over the last year. Seattle Police Sergeant Eric Spokonski says ERPOs have been an invaluable tool for the department dealing with adults in crisis, and he thinks they can be helpful with kids too, but he stressed the need for clarity.
It's really essential to clarify how these ERPOs are going to work and be utilized with minors and with juveniles. And really taking a bilateral approach to a public safety and what action should occur with the legal gun owners who have guns shared in the home, okay, and trying to balance that out with those individuals.
So this is the idea where if your kid is considered a risk, then are they going to take your gun or just insist that you secure it so the kid can't get to it?
So I'm going to get to that. This would require the parents or guardians of a kid served with an extreme risk protection order also be notified about the requirement to safely store their gun and the possible criminal prosecution that they would face if they don't, and then that kid gets access. So that's a little bit more watered down than when we talked about this a couple of months back. Uh-huh. The idea was maybe going to be that they would have to get that gun out of the house. It doesn't sound like that's the case now. This competitive target shooter, though, came to speak out against the proposal and has big concerns.
Right now, in my house, there's 11 45 automatic pistols. You want some kid to make a false claim of a harassment or threats by my child, then he's going to get an ERPO. They're going to come take my guns. How do I get my guns back even though I did nothing and they were confiscated in violation of the Fourth Amendment? Tell me that, Senator. I'd like to know.
That was a question for Senator Mark Munkin.
What's the answer?
So they are not allowed to, in committee, directly answer a question. So it was a question to Monka Dingra, and she said she would talk to him offline. So I'm assuming that happened. But again, here's the deal. There's nothing in this legislation that says anything about taking any parents' weapons. And when the question came up about whether there's any penalties or how this would go down during this yesterday, essentially my takeaway was what they're saying is you're going to have to tell this parent that they have to safely store this weapon away from that kid so the kid can't have access, and then essentially direct them to the provisions in 1639, that penalty that is in 1639 for safe storage, which, remember, is a criminal penalty, would apply in this case.
Did anybody ask this gentleman how he makes sure that those guns do not fall into the wrong hands?
They did not. It's not that kind of setup when it's at a committee hearing, it didn't come up.
I'd be curious. I mean, I assume, because gun owners would take that pretty seriously, right?
I would say so. And especially if you're talking about competitive shooters in general, when I've talked to folks like that before, they have gun cases that have locks on them, especially if there are children in the home. I didn't get a chance to ask them myself, so that's a little speculation. But ACLU also had some concerns about this bill, specifically about how long records would be kept on file for kids that end up getting hit with these ERPOs.
And so we'd really like to limit the availability of these records for those purposes so that young people who have rehabilitated, who've moved on with their lives, who are no longer in a point of crisis, don't have to constantly be tagged by the state as having been an extreme risk.
They also had some issues regarding the overall vagueness of the language of the entire ERPO statute as it applies to adults as well. So there's going to be some stuff that's going to be hashed out as this moves its way through the legislature. There was also talk about, hey, maybe we should have an amendment in here when we're talking about a kid in crisis. Maybe it's better to have a mental health intervention of some sort before we jump on the gun rights issues.
Okay, now the other gun story that's out there are these shootings along Highway 509. 11 shootings since last June. Some have been aimed at homes, some aimed at cars. One blinded a 14-year-old boy, and the sheriff, Mitzi Johanknik, was asked, is it safe to drive 509?
I came down 509 from Seattle here today. I travel 509 frequently in my private vehicle, come down here to work. So these are all things that we have to evaluate and solve But we're letting folks know just to be aware.
Right. So now, of course, be aware. What does that mean? How do I defend myself against some unknown person taking pot shots?
When you're in your vehicle. Yeah, I don't know. I have no.
So do you know what this task force is doing?
I know that they're working together to try, and I believe they weren't extremely forthcoming with what information they had yesterday, even for sure whether these incidents are all specifically connected. But I think the message is to be vigilant and that there's too many. So I would suspect that they
believe
they're connected.
Well, I agree with being vigilant. And here's what I'd like to see them do. They have this detection technology, this audio detection technology for gunshots. Why don't they plant those sensors up and down along the highway and triangulate? And then you have an app so that if it turns out the shot was coming from near where you live, your phone goes off and says gunshot detected 100 feet to the south, so that responsible gun owners can go check this out.
Yeah. Right? Well, and I would love to
recruit like the NRA to set up this network, because it doesn't help them to have somebody like this on the loose either, right?
No, it doesn't. And certainly not. No, absolutely not. Does not help gun owners. It definitely is an issue for all sides. I asked, by the way, this morning, I reached out to State Patrol to see if we do have this gunshot locator system. I know it was discussed several years ago, I think specific to Seattle Police. I don't believe they have it. He did not know about State Patrol. Sheriff's Department is also looking into it for me, but it doesn't sound like that's anything that we have. There is that, and I think it's quite costly and that it's generally used for military purposes right now. Uh-huh.
Some cities have them, but I would simply observe we have, what, approximately 200,000 of the best software engineers in the world living within the
sound of my
voice. You're telling me that maybe they could rehabilitate my dead Jibo to, you know, detect gunshots. I don't know, but there's so much equipment out there. It just seems to me this kind of thing should be almost instantly detectable, and we'd be able to respond to it right away.
Absolutely. And right, you can respond to that right away. And then, you know, that wouldn't help that person who got fired at right then. But at least hopefully you would be able to catch that person, maybe get there right away. So I would love to hear more about that technology, see if that's something we can get. I don't believe we have it right now.
Kyra is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.